ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We think that social housing ought to be good enough, and it's a horrible phrase.
I'd call it the naturehood, the neighbourhood of nature.
Big questions, real solutions. Life Matters with me, Tegan Taylor, is where your stories shape the national conversation.
I'm nobody's darling, believe you me.
It would have been true love from the beginning.
We unpick big stories that matter to you. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's estimated to have cost the lives and injured more than a million Russian soldiers.
And wounded or killed nearly half a million Ukrainians.
President Volodymyr Zelensky says Vladimir Putin has started World War III.
4 years on, there's no sign it's ending soon. I'm Kylie Morris.
And I'm Latika Burke, in Kyiv for this episode of Global Roaming.
So, Latika, you're in Ukraine. Where have you been? What have you seen?
Yeah, Kylie, quite a momentous trip. So we started off, we actually came through Chisinau this time, through Moldova, which I haven't been to. Got to Odessa, which is a beautiful, beautiful Black Sea port city in southern Ukraine. I haven't been there before. Absolutely gorgeous, very Parisian vibe. Of course, like so much of Ukraine, covered in snow because they've had this record snowfall. I mean, people in Odessa just don't deal with snow because they just don't have it. But it wasn't just the snow holding them back. The night we were there, of course, 1 a.m. waking up to huge explosions. I must admit, Kylie, I thought they were a mile or two away outside my window. The next morning we went and had a look. They were 7 minutes away. So that just brings home how random but close these things can be any night of the week here in Ukraine, just trying to live your normal life.
Well, it is the fourth anniversary of the war. As you say, people are becoming accustomed to these nightly raids and so much else that goes along with it. Family being split and half the family being in one country and some people remaining in Ukraine. Lots of families split by the fact that some are fighting. We have a great guest this week to talk about that. I know that you know him, Yuri Sack. So I'll get you to introduce him.
Well, Yuri used to work at the Ministry of Defence and he runs a very successful public affairs company in Ukraine. They partner with the government from time to time on lots of projects. But really what this all adds up to is that he is an incredibly forceful, forthright ambassador and communicator for Ukraine.
Here he is now, Yuri Sack.
Yuri Sack, welcome to Global Roaming. 4 years on now, can we say that Ukraine is in a position to win this war or not?
In many ways, we have already won. Because the fact that Ukraine is still standing, the fact that 4 years on, we are still holding off the attack of one of the largest armies in the world, the fact that the will of the Ukrainian people has not been broken by the incessant missile and drone attacks, now, that in itself is a miracle and a victory. Well, at the same time, if we look back at how we ourselves defined victory even 2 years ago, and if we compare it with how we talk about victory today, we have moved the goalpost. So we no longer talk about the renewal of Ukraine's territorial integrity to the level it was in 1991. We don't even talk about going back to the level of our territories that we had in 2022. But that's not because we have forgiven the war criminals and the terrorist state Russia. That's not because we think that it is okay to live in a world where one country can invade another, kill people and get away with it. No, it is because we are desperate to end this war. This is not us giving up on our territorial sovereignty or on our independence. This is just us showing to the world that we're flexible. When we understand that 4 years down the line, time has come to really be creative about ending this aggression.
Yuri, do you remember exactly where you were when you realized Ukraine was under attack from Russia 4 years ago? How did you find out?
I was in bed with my wife, with my children sleeping next door in their bedroom. And all of a sudden, my wife jumps up in the middle of the night and screams, "The war has begun." And, you know, I was shell-shocked. Well, I jump up as well. I look out the window and I see explosions. I see the night sky lit with the fire from the explosions from the missiles. So next split second, I grabbed my kids and took them to the basement because it felt like the end of the war has begun.
You said your wife knew instantly the war had begun. Did that mean that you were fully expecting, you were anticipating a Russian strike?
Because of my connections in the government, I was tipped off on that evening of the 23rd of February. I was on a kid's birthday party in the middle of Kyiv. And all of a sudden, and of course, everybody, you know, kids were playing and parents were sitting there and already talking about the possibility of war, because that's all we talked about for weeks by then. And my phone rings and a friend of mine tells me, "Grab your kids and leave Central Kyiv ASAP," which is exactly what I did. Of course, I at home, I had like two dogs, two cats, two kids, and we didn't even have time to properly pack anything. So we just grabbed documents, you know, some like credit cards, keys from the car and our animals. And we stormed out of the central Kyiv, to the outskirts where my mother-in-law lived back then.
Did you imagine when this started that 4 years on, you'd be giving interviews like this, you know, describing Ukraine's resolve to keep fighting?
Not in my wildest and worst nightmares would I have ever thought that we'll be sitting here 4 years after that first attack and talking about, you know, about the fact that this can go on for another 4 years. So essentially, what I remember very well from the first week of the war was the whole of Ukraine, you know, every evening we celebrated another day of surviving. So when we reached 1 week, it was like a miracle. Like, look, Russia still hasn't destroyed us. Yes, we are in our basements and we're hiding and we're covering up our kids. And of course, back then it felt like, okay, it's going to be a couple of months maximum. 4 weeks down the line, here we are.
Does it still feel like that, Yuri, that life is a day-by-day prospect for Ukrainians? And what does Ukraine look like once that day-by-day stops, if there is some sort of peace? What country are you left with?
That's a very tough question because on the one hand, Lechika, you've seen it yourself, like when there is, like for example, in Kyiv, during daytime, it almost feels normal. Shops are open, there are traffic jams, the snow is falling, people go to supermarkets, kids go to school.
It's actually a bit scary how normal it feels. You know, you whinge about things like, gee, this road is full of ice, slip over. And you can really easily forget, hang on, a drone could come down on me any second.
That, and of course, these days, because our energy infrastructure was destroyed and decimated, so we still have daily power cuts. You know, I am staying in central Kyiv and I think I have electricity maybe like 4 or 5 hours a day. But that's just enough to recharge my batteries and my alternative sources of energy. Like all the lamps in my flat are chargeable and so on and so forth. It's like really like unnerving and uncomfortable. So it's a new normal, but it's a very, very difficult and tough new normal.
President Zelensky has said that Putin has started World War III, Yuri. Why would he say that? I mean, this is a conflict contained within Ukraine's borders. So he's kind of exaggerating, isn't he?
It's contained within Ukraine's borders for now. And we have to be aware of the fact that Putin is a man on a mission. His mission is the reinstatement of the might of the Soviet Empire, which they have lost when the Soviet Union collapsed. And when you speak to our European partners, by now it's obvious that they have fully woken up to the new reality and they understand we are very near the beginning of an all-out war which could be, you know, devastating for the whole of the continent. But of course, we still have a chance to stop it. And our superpower as the coalition of free democratic nations is our unity.
Yuri, a lot of people have put a lot of stock in the idea that Russia is on the brink of collapse. Any day now, the sanctions will ruin the economy. There will be a dissent in Russia. He may face an uprising. We've seen none of those things 4 years on. Today, I attended a briefing with Western officials who said that actually for the first time, Russia is now not able to recruit men at the same rate it has suffered casualties over the last 3 months. First time that that's happened. And they say that that's really significant. Where is the tension point between the obvious fatigue in Ukrainian society and the pressure and the time it's taking to put on Russia to see any of those gains that people are hoping for?
For the Ukrainian people, of course, every time we hear the estimates or forecasts of experts that Russia is about to crumble and, you know, its economy is frailing and they are experiencing irrecoverable or irreversible problems, of course, we like to hear that. But we have heard that so much in the last 4 years that we take it with a pinch of salt. You know, all these forecasts, they make us feel good, but we understand that it's we shouldn't hold our breath yet. But I would like to also say this. You know, by virtue of my work and responsibilities, I also monitor very closely the Russian information space. And the amount of information now coming out from Russia, even like from Russian propaganda about the problems in their banking sector, about the problems with in their like construction industry, about the huge layoffs in automobile industry, about the inability of people to be paid salaries. So these problems, which of course are the result of sanctions and, you know, the sanctions loop tightening, they have a cumulative effect. And In my sort of world view, I think this is exactly how it will happen. There will come a tipping point after which there will be no the point of no return for Russia. But until that happens, we here have to stay strong. Our partners have to stay strong.
Yuri, how do Ukrainians feel about the way the world's responded to this conflict? You know, the Europeans talk about unity and talk about, you know, really supporting, standing shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine, but there are still demands that they do more, particularly in terms of finance. Donald Trump said he'd end the war within 24 hours, but he's bullied and ridiculed Zelensky. Countries like Australia have made contributions, but do everyday Ukrainians feel like they've enjoyed a sense of solidarity from other nations, or do they feel they've been forgotten?
All Ukrainians know very well that without the support of our partners, large or small, you know, there are countries, of course, there are countries who could have given us more. And dare I say, Australia is one of them. Because Australia has given us a lot of support. We still, you know, you ask any Ukrainian in the street what is a Bushmaster, and, you know, kids will tell you that these are the big, large armored vehicles that Australia gave us a long time ago. So that's like part of our joint history, and that was bonded us. But at the same time, we know, like, for example, that Australia, in a similar way as Norway, for example, right? These are countries that, because of this war, almost accidentally, but they, because of the changes in the sort of global prices in the global markets for certain commodities, that there was more kind of money coming into your coffers. And sometimes it just feels kind of weird, like, why not do more? But again, I will repeat, if it wasn't for the Western support, we'd probably have like Russian flags flying in central Kyiv by now, or it would have been a bloodbath, like all over Ukraine, not just in the east. And the South.
Yuri, a lot of emphasis and focus is put on Donald Trump's attempts to end this war. But is he the only world leader that can broker a peace here?
Well, look, let's just look at the facts. Did anyone else, was anyone else able to bring these, bring Ukraine and Russia to the negotiating table? No. Whether these negotiations will lead to the outcome that, for example, Ukraine wants, that's a question which we'll see the answer to later on. Whether that's a negotiating process which Russia takes seriously, I think we know the answer to that one, right? But it still continues.
I mean, there have been peace talks, you know, this past week, Yuri, and I think they wrapped early and everyone went home and there was no sign of any progress. I mean, is the process as it stands viable? I take your point that President Trump has been able to bring the parties together, but given what we know of how these talks are proceeding, do you think they stand any chance of succeeding as things stand without a major shift from either Russia or Ukraine?
Kylie, if by shift you mean that either Ukraine or Russia will give up on our objectives, then we are in a stalemate and these are irreconcilable positions, which kind of suggest that this negotiating process will not lead anywhere. But having said that, I have to say that, first of all, we need to keep this diplomatic track alive and open because we never know how things will change. So a couple of months down the line, things can dramatically change. And we need to have this track alive and kicking because, you know, we will have the infrastructure in place for meaningful negotiations to happen. If now we, for example, throw a tantrum and say, oh, this is not working, forget it, let's just continue fighting, then when the situation will change, and hopefully it will, and hopefully it will be in our favor, we don't have that necessary infrastructure. So, you know, everybody's kind of skeptical, of course, because of the Russians. Because, look, we have been flexible during this negotiating process. Russians have stuck to their guns. The Russians have stuck to their unrealistic demands. They haven't moved an inch, right? So they still say, all right, we are happy to talk, but all our objectives have to be met. Which is not really a negotiating process, right? This is blackmailing or terrorism or call it what you like. So mixed feelings, right? On the one hand, we're skeptical, but on the other hand, we have to continue to work on this because sooner or later, it may come in very handy.
Yuri, when I got to Ukraine this week, I had read all the stories about your freezing winter. I had read lots of stories about fatigue kicking in, that people were on the edge, they wanted peace. Not at any price, but they really wanted it. And yet actually what I have detected in the time I've been here has been a kind of new resolve and a new determination. Can you talk me through how that winter has affected the Ukrainian sentiment and morale?
In short, I think it made us stronger. It made us more angry. It made us more united. And I will explain. So me personally, two times during the last 4 years, I was at a point when I had like doubts about what my people, what I as part of my people, what we as Ukrainians, we will do. So on February 24th, you know, after the first explosions and the first missiles reached Kyiv, I seriously was thinking like, how are Ukrainians going to act? Is it going to be a fight or flight reaction? Are we going to put up a fight or are we going to beg for, you know, mercy from the aggressor? And my people made me proud then, because when I saw, you know, it wasn't possible to actually watch without tears in your eyes, because when I saw how people united, how people have shown readiness to actually sacrifice their lives if necessary and protect our country, that was just divine. And I've had very similar sentiment before the beginning of this winter. Again, I began to kind of doubt and think, because it was on the cards. We knew that tough winter was coming, and we knew that Russia will use this as an opportunity to commit this climate genocide through freezing us to death. So I actually thought, well, and with the negotiating process at the background, I thought, well, this is not looking good, right? When people will start freezing, they will start losing faith in the possibility of actually somehow pulling through. And that will have a knock-on effect on the negotiating process. And this is, of course, what Russians were banking on. Just think about it. When you're in a flat and it's 3 degrees above Celsius and you're with kids, with your cats, like my cat used to, like, thanks God, like I have this electrical little blanket. So my cat would sleep on this little electric blanket. In my colleague's flat, again, 3 degrees. So he's sleeping in like ski suit and hats and everything. And you have like the windows are iced over from both sides, from the outside and from the inside. But, you know, after like first 3 days, This is our superpower. You know, we adapted. And the government actually responded very well because they put up these military-style tents with, you know, the ability for people to go and get, like warm water, drinks, and if necessary, even to, like, sleep in those tents overnight. So I think one message this winter sends to the world is Russia will never win. In just a few days' time, this weekend, the winter will end and spring will begin. The first day of spring will bring us the message of hope. And I think on that day, you know, Ukrainians across Ukraine and probably around the world as well will give each other a hug and will say to each other, well, thanks God we pulled through. We will prevail. We will stand our ground. We will continue to get support from our partners, because I think when our partners, whether in Australia or in the White House, when they see that this winter has not killed Ukrainians, that this winter has not destroyed us, that it has not broken our will, I think it will inspire everyone into action. It's not impossible. It's like, look, it's a tragedy, but it's like an ending in a Hollywood movie, right? So I really hope that the world looks at Ukraine and thinks these people are giving everything they can. So out of compassion, out of generosity of spirit, everybody should join in, because it's the freedom war that we are fighting, and it's not just our freedom, right? I've said it 1,000 times in the last 4 years. It's a standoff between good and evil, between tyrannies and freedom. It's obvious why this fight is worth joining.
Yuri, thank you so much for appearing on the show and for giving us so much of your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Kylie. My pleasure. Latika, good to see you again.
You too, Yuri.
Well, Latika, a lot to talk about there. I mean, he's such a kind of passionate character, isn't he, and such a strong advocate for the Ukrainian cause. But I think it was what really struck me was that springtime in Kyiv line, you know, Ukraine looking for a Hollywood ending. You're there. Are you seeing that view or that mood consistently across the people you're speaking with?
Not consistently. I think it's very true to say that Ukrainians are not up for surrender. That's absolutely non-negotiable. What there is a mood for is peace, but on just terms, and that's really difficult to achieve. And so that then leads Ukrainians to believe, okay, we're not going to get peace because Russia doesn't want peace. It's not us, it's them. And we may be in this for the longer term. There is fatigue. There is a lot of anxiety when you talk to Ukrainians. But I do think that what Yuri said about this, you know, we asked this question, this renewed vigor, this renewed resolve, this renewed determination, that is something I've been surprised to detect, and it is very much current there.
It's interesting though, because when he was describing the hopelessness of the peace talks and the fact that they aren't getting anywhere, that no one is shifting, what he was really describing was a war of attrition. And I guess the best at the moment seems to be, from Ukraine's perspective, a war of attrition where Ukraine prevails. It doesn't feel like a strategy necessarily. It just feels like a lot more war for many more months and years to come, because there's certainly no sign, as he said, of the Russians changing their demands. Is there an appetite for, I mean, it's one thing to talk about renewal, but renewal when the conditions don't change is challenging, right?
Yes, but I've been surprised at the optimism in certain ranks. So I was speaking to somebody very close to the defense minister of Ukraine, and this person said over the next year, he said, we don't think there's peace this year. We think it's next year. And here's the reason why. We go after the oil. We do more long-range strikes on the oil refineries in Russia. And we are going to extend the kill zone. So at the moment, the front line is essentially a stalemate. It's around 10 kilometers deep on average, but it is deeper in other areas. And what they want to do is double that zone to 20 kilometers. And in that zone, you have essentially guys on both sides sitting in holes or bunkers in the ground operating drones trying to kill each other. That's what the front line looks like now. It's not trench warfare, which it was a couple of years ago. So they want to extend that, and then that will give them more protection, more buffer zone. And what you essentially therefore have, and someone was explaining this to me, is a quasi-demilitarized zone that they've set up like in the Koreas, but without that being formally recognized. So I have been surprised at the strength of confidence in some Ukrainians. I think the challenge now is filtering that down to the society, ensuring that morale stays strong, and then, of course, mobilization, which continues to be a big challenge for the Ukrainians.
We touched on the issue of how many Ukrainians have left. Fiona Hill, the Russian expert, has been talking to Laura Tingle on the ABC, and she said that it's now estimated that 8 million of the 40 million population of Ukrainians has left the country. And there are another several million now inside territory that's occupied by Russia. So that means the total national population has dropped to close to 25 million. So I was really interested in your question about how do you come back from this? Like, what is the Ukraine that emerges even under the best conditions from this conflict? There are real questions, I think, about how many of these Ukrainians will ever go home.
Yes, I had an MP say to me tonight that the economy is ruined, you know, the country is ruined. That was the word that they used. And that's probably not an exaggeration, because a lot will then depend, if there is peace, on what coalition partners do to help rebuild this country. And that's not just the physical roads and you know, homes and things. The Ukrainians are actually very good at repairing and rebuilding their housing and buildings after drone attacks. But by that, it is a demographic challenge, huge. I mean, there's a reason why they don't send 18 to 25-year-old men to the front line. It's because they're trying to save and preserve their own culture and their own people by allowing young men to hopefully have a chance at life before and try and end this war before they turn of age, where they'll be sent to the front line. And then, of course, the economy. How they rebuild an economy where so many Ukrainians have been offered refuge in Europe, and they've been there for many years now. Their kids are going to schools. They're established. They've put down roots. Yes, they're living half lives where they might not know if they're ever coming back to Ukraine, but gradually, as every year goes on, they feel more and more at home in their European countries, which also, by the way, will be offering them a greater chance of opportunity and salaries than what they might get in Ukraine. These are really difficult and not very publicly talked about issues in Ukraine.
And of course, as Yuri was saying, this is partly Putin's objective in order to empty out, to try and erase Ukrainian culture. An effective way of achieving that is forcing Ukrainians, you know, to go and live in other countries. Latik, it's been great to have you there. Travel safely back to London, where you'll be next time we speak. If anyone is listening and wants to, you know, give us some feedback on this episode, please don't forget to write to us. We love your questions. You can reach us at global.roaming@abc.net.au. Geraldine and Hamish will be back tomorrow talking about Syria and the camps that have held those Australian families seeking to return. See you later, Latika.
See you next week, Kylie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.